Luke 24:13-53, the 89th talk in a series entitled The Gospel of Luke, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 28, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're in the Gospel of Luke. We're actually going to finish the Gospel of Luke this morning. We don't have a whole lot left. And in fact, it won't take us all that long. If you can think of questions that you have about the stuff in the Gospel in general, save those. We'll have some time for questions at the end. And then I'm going to spend some time making four or five points here with regard to a broader section of Luke here. We're going to start in chapter 24, verse 13. Now behold, two of them were going that very same day to a village that was about 7 miles from Jerusalem. Its name was Emmaus. They were talking with each other about all the things that had taken place. While they were talking and pondering together, Jesus himself drew near and began walking along with them, but their eyes were prevented from recognizing him. Then he said to them, "What are these stories that you are telling one another as you walk?" Then they stood still, looking sad. One of them, named Cleopas, responded to him and said, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who is also unaware of the things which have happened in it in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "The things about Jesus the Nazarene. He was a man, a prophet, mighty in deed and word in the sight of God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him over to a sentence of death, and they crucified him. We had been hoping that he was the one who was about to redeem Israel. Then along with all these things, this day makes the third day since these things happened. Now indeed some women from among us amazed us. Being early morning at the tomb, they did not find his body. They came, claiming to have seen an appearance of angels. These women claimed that he is alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just exactly as the women had in fact said, but they did not see him. Then he said to them, "O foolish men, and slow in heart to believe on the basis of all that the prophets have said. Was it not necessary for the Christ to suffer these things and then to enter into his glory? Then, beginning from Moses and then from all the prophets, he explained to them in all the scriptures the things pertaining to himself." Then they approached the village where they were going, and he acted as if he intended to go further, but they urged him, saying, "Stay with us, for it is toward evening, and the day has already come to an end." So he went in to stay with them. Now it happened that when he had reclined at the table with them, he took the bread and blessed it, and breaking it, he began passing it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. Then he vanished from their sight. They said to one another, "Were not our hearts enlightened within us as he was speaking to us on the road, while he was opening up the scriptures to us?" And they got up that very hour and returned to Jerusalem, and they found gathered together the 11 and those who were with them, saying, "The Lord really has been raised, and he has been seen by Simon." Then they proceeded to relate what happened on the road and how he was revealed to them at the breaking of the bread. While they were telling about these things, he himself stood in the midst of them and said to them, "Shalom to you." Then, having been startled, they grew quite afraid. They were thinking that they were seeing a spirit. So he said to them, "Why are you disturbed? And why do objections rise up in your hearts? See my hands and my feet, that I am he? Touch me and look at me, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see me having." And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. While they were still unbelieving because of their joy and were standing amazed, he said to them, "Do you have anything to eat here?" They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in front of them. That's the first long section in this chapter. The chronology seems to be, this is happening on the Sunday, the first day of the week, the day when the empty tomb was discovered by the women that we talked about last week. The women come early in the morning, right around the break of day, find the empty tomb. They run back to the hiding place of the disciples in some house in the city, and they report what they've seen. They've gone to the tomb, the stone is rolled away, there's no body in the tomb, and what's more, some angels appeared to them and told them that he has been raised from the dead and some other stuff. That was reported to the disciples. Apparently, sometime right after that has occurred, Cleopas and his companion leave to travel to Emmaus because they're not aware that Jesus has appeared to anybody when they're recounting their story to Jesus. So apparently they left sometime after the initial report from the women. As I outlined last week, Mary and the other women with her follow John and Peter back to the tomb. Peter and John see the empty tomb. They leave. Mary stays behind. And that's when the first appearance of Jesus happens. The first appearance of Jesus apparently seems to be to Mary Magdalene. We don't know when he appeared to Simon, so it's possible that happened before Mary Magdalene. But we have no account of his appearance to Simon, just the report that he did. So the first appearance was either to Simon or to Mary Magdalene right outside the tomb. She then, and the other women with her, go back to the hiding place once again to report that they've actually seen the Lord. Cleopas doesn't know that, and his traveling companion. So sometime between Mary Magdalene's first report to the disciples gathered together and her second report, sometime between there, these two men have left. They're traveling to Emmaus. I don't believe we know where Emmaus is, as I recall. But the account tells us it's roughly 7 miles, somewhere in some direction, 7 miles from Jerusalem. They're traveling there. As they're traveling, they're pondering. They're thinking about what on earth is going on. We see in them, as we see in all the disciples, in the women, everybody involved in these events has a really, really hard time accepting the truth of the matter, namely that Jesus has popped up from the dead. This guy that we saw crucified is now alive. That they're trying to sort out what could possibly be going out. What were those angels really? What were they really saying to us? What really happened to the body? In the appearance where Mary Magdalene sees Jesus, she thinks he's the gardener, is asking him, "Where did you put the body?" And when he finally discloses to her who he is. So all of them are having a really hard time with this. They're walking down the road, traveling, trying to make sense out of all this, and another traveler comes along and joins them. He starts asking about, "What are you talking about?" And they tell him the whole story of the crucifixion and the empty tomb and the appearance of angels and the report from the women. They tell him all these things. And he begins to kind of rebuke them and chastise them. Well, isn't that kind of like what the prophet said would happen to the Messiah? I mean, so why are you so surprised? That's what the prophets were talking about. They still don't understand who they're talking to. They arrive in Emmaus. They have dinner together. And in the process of eating dinner, Jesus takes bread, breaks it to offer it to them. And something in that encounter brings about a note of recognition, and they realize that it's Jesus, at which point he just disappears, pops out of existence. Not pops out of existence, pops out of visualization. They respond at that point, and they say, "Were not our hearts enlightened within us as he was speaking to us on the road?" I think most English translations have, "Were not our hearts burning within us as he was speaking to us on the road?" Shades of Joseph Smith. I don't think that's the idea. I don't think it's a visceral thing that they're describing there. It's not a burning of the heart that they're referring to. The word is to kindle. And so I think the idea is, weren't we beginning to get a glimpse of insight into these things as he was unfolding the scriptures for us on the road? So putting two and two together, they realize they have been tutored by Jesus himself on the road and at dinner. They've been tutored by him to put together the pieces about how the events that they have just been eyewitnesses to actually are consistent with what the prophets themselves have said. So they get up that very hour. They return to Jerusalem. They find all the same people gathered together at their hiding place in Jerusalem. And before they can tell their story, all those people say, the Lord really has risen. Simon saw him. Simon is Peter. That he appeared to Peter. And they proceed, then Cleopas and his companion proceed to tell the story of what happened to them and how Jesus was revealed to them as being the risen Lord as they were eating. In the very midst of that event, then, Jesus appears to all of them. They are in what is probably a locked room. John tells us it was shut, but the word for shut can also mean locked. They're hiding out here because they're afraid for their lives. Their teacher has been crucified. They themselves are probably marked men. They know that, and they're afraid for their lives. So they're hiding out. They're in a locked room, probably, and all of a sudden in their midst, Jesus appears to them. He stood in the midst of them, said, hi, howdy. They become startled and quite afraid because they think that they're seeing, that it's called, seeing a spirit. I think we would say seeing a ghost. So they think they're seeing a ghost, but he said to them, why are you objecting to what it is that you're seeing? See my hands and my feet. And I think what he must mean by that is the marks in his hands and the marks in his feet. That seems to be a significant sign of his identity in many of the encounters. So see the marks of the nail prints in my hands and my feet, that I am he. Touch me and look at me, for a spirit or a ghost does not have flesh and bones as you're seeing me have. So I'm tangible. Look, I'm not just this translucent hologram. I really am a material physical being. So he showed them his hands and feet, and then it says, while they were still unbelieving because of their joy and were standing amazed, he said to them, do you have anything to eat here? They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and some manuscripts add, and honey, and he took it and ate it in front of them. Now, why? What's that all about? I think it's just one more piece of evidence that he's not a ghost, he's not a hallucination, he's not some other kind of appearance. He actually is a being who is quite capable of functioning as a being and eating. Okay, so that's the only account like this where he appears to all of them that Luke is going to give us. The other Gospels mention the fact that at this particular occasion, Thomas was not there. And so 8 days later, they're in virtually the same situation with Thomas being there, and Jesus appears to them once again and singles out Thomas to give the same kind of evidence to Thomas that he gave to the other disciples. So Luke now ends his account of Jesus appearing to people, and he then ends this account in the final section, in starting with verse 44. It's not at all clear where you should make the breaks here, but I would argue that verse 44 is a break now to a new section. Now he said to them, these are the things which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things that are written about me in the law of Moses, in the prophets, and in the Psalms must be fulfilled. Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures. And he said to them, So is it written that the Christ must suffer and rise up again from the dead on the third day, and further that on the basis of his name, repentance and the forgiveness of sins must be proclaimed to all the nations, beginning from Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. Now look, I am sending the promise of my Father upon you, but you are to stay in the city until you are clothed with power from on high. He led them out to Bethany, and lifting up his hands, he blessed them. And it came about that when he was blessing them, he separated from them and was taken up into the sky. And they, after worshiping him, returned to Jerusalem with great joy, and they were in the temple praising and expressing their gratitude to God for the duration. What could be really confusing about Luke's account here is that Luke doesn't give us any kind of, he doesn't orient us in the chronology here. This is now that which occurred on the last several days of Jesus, before Jesus' ascension. It's several weeks after the Easter Sunday, the resurrection, several weeks after they have seen Jesus rise from the dead. In fact, we're basically 40 days later. If you're not willing to look at this charitably, you might say Luke is just confused here because he's having the ascension happen right after his first appearance to the people in the room. He doesn't even tell us the 8 days later with Thomas. So Luke is confused. He thinks the ascension happened right away. But let's turn to Acts briefly, the very first chapter of Acts. The first account I composed, Theophilus, and the first account is what we know of as the Gospel of Luke. The first account I composed, Theophilus, about all that Jesus began to do and teach until the day when he was taken up to heaven after he had, with respect to the Holy Spirit, given instructions to the apostles whom he had chosen. To these he also presented himself alive after his suffering by many convincing proofs, appearing to them over a period of 40 days and speaking of the things concerning the kingdom of God. So in Acts 1, Luke is fully aware, fully cognizant of the fact that there's a span of 40 days from the time in which Jesus was raised, or crucified at least, until the events that are about to unfold that he's going to tell us about, starting with verse 4. Gathering them together, he commanded them not to leave Jerusalem, but to wait for what the Father had promised, which he said, "You heard of from me. For John baptized with water, but you will be baptized with the Holy Spirit not many days from now." So when they had come together, they were asking him, saying, "Lord, is it this time you are restoring the kingdom of Israel?" He said to them, "It is not for you to know times or epochs, which the Father has fixed by his own authority, but you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you shall be my witnesses both in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and even to the remotest part of the earth." And after he had said these things, he was lifted up while they were looking on, and a cloud received him out of their sight. And as they were gazing intently into the sky while he was going, behold, two men in white clothing stood beside them. They also said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into the sky? This Jesus who has been taken up from you into heaven will come in just the same way as you have watched him go into heaven." And then they returned to Jerusalem. So the opening of his second account actually recounts the same event that he ends his first account with. Well, he locates that event in time in Acts, namely it's at the very end of these 40 days, 10 days before the promise of the Father, the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, will be sent upon them. And 40 days into it, he's telling them, go back to Jerusalem and wait. Wait those 10 days for the Spirit to come. So however much it may appear that Luke is confused at the end of his first account, that same author is very unconfused in the opening of the second account. So I think the most logical explanation is we are making a mistake when we think that there's no gap in time between, say, 43 and verse 44. Starting with verse 44, he's simply giving a digested form of the nature of Jesus' teaching over those 40 days. What is it that in his various appearances to them he taught them? He taught them that these were my words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things which are written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled. And he opened their minds to understand the scriptures. So that which he did with Cleopas and his companion on the road to Emmaus, he did with all the disciples off and on over and over again over the course of those 40 days. And then he charged them to be his witnesses of these things, told them at the end of this time, told them to wait in the city, And 10 days later, we have the account of Pentecost when the Spirit comes upon them. The actual chronology here is something along the lines of, we know that they're still in Jerusalem 8 days later. We don't know how much longer beyond that that they stayed in Jerusalem. But eventually, they travel back to Galilee. Jesus had instructed them, apparently, that's what the angel said, had apparently instructed them to meet him at a particular mountain, and I would guess at a particular time in Galilee. So they all make their way back to Galilee. They end up spending 2 or 3 weeks in Galilee. During that time, John tells us he appeared to several of them as they were fishing one morning. We know that he must have appeared to them at the mountain where he told them to meet them, and there are probably a number of other appearances that Jesus made to various of them at various times while he was in Galilee. And then a couple of weeks before, or maybe even just 10 days before Pentecost, they have arrived back in Jerusalem, and that's the account that we're getting at the end of Luke, is what did he finally charge them, what was his final instruction to them just before he ascended into heaven those 10 days before Pentecost. Okay. So that's the story as Luke tells it. I don't think there's anything else there that needs explanation. Let me just make 5 or 6 points here, and then I'll open it up to your questions. First of all, it is interesting that Jesus insists that what happened to him, his crucifixion, his death, his resurrection 3 days later, all of that could have been understood to have been predicted by the Old Testament prophets. It would be wonderful to have Jesus' teaching that he was giving the disciples during that day, where he was taking them to Moses and the prophets and all the Old Testament scriptures and showing how they, in fact, established that what had happened to him was supposed to happen to him, prophetically speaking. It's standard among the Jews today to take a lot of the passages probably that Jesus would have said were applying to me and to reinterpret them and understanding them differently. Something like Isaiah 53. But as we know, if we've given any thought to biblical interpretation at all, biblical interpretation is not easy. It's very easy to go to a passage and orient somebody to the passage in a particular way and say, look at it this way. Will it be a plausible reading? Yeah, absolutely, of course. I can make you read a passage plausibly in a particular way. But of course, the task of biblical exegesis is not to come up with a plausible reading of a passage. The task of biblical exegesis is to come up with that reading of the passage that corresponds with what its author intended. And that's a different task, and it's a much more difficult task. It's relatively, because we're intelligent, it's relatively easy to come up with a plausible reading. It's much more difficult to make contact with the mind of the biblical author himself, or any author, for that matter. So however plausible any other reading of these prophets might be, the question is, but is that what was intended? Is that what Isaiah meant? Is that what God meant speaking through Isaiah? Now, granted, our interpretations in the final analysis need to be intelligent. They need to be rational. They need to be reasonable. They need to be interpretations that follow the evidence of the text itself, the language itself, the syntax itself, the background itself, and so on. We can't do back to the Jews what they would be doing to us. We can't just come up with a reading of Isaiah 53 that makes it plausible that it's Jesus and call it good. It's not enough that it be plausible. It has to be right. What Jesus was doing is persuading the disciples that Isaiah really was speaking of him, that these other passages really were speaking of him. And I would love to know what all those passages are that he had in mind. But alas, we only know what got preserved in the arguments of the letters of the New Testament. As for me, it seems to me, in light of who Jesus proved himself to be through the signs that accompanied his claims to be the very Son of God himself, if anyone has the insight, the understanding, and therefore the authority to know what was intended in the scriptures, it would be Jesus. So I just think we're crazy if we don't give him the benefit of the doubt. And if he says that these passages were talking about him, I think he knows what he's talking about. We've already talked somewhat about reconciling the gospel accounts. The hardest part to reconcile are the appearances of the women to the tomb, the empty tomb, and we talked about that last week. In fact, that's all I talked about last week. From then on out, the accounts are actually relatively easy to reconcile. The most difficult part I already talked about is what does Luke think he's doing? Because he puts in immediate juxtaposition Jesus' appearance to the disciples in the room and the ascension at Bethany. Well, Luke doesn't mean that they're chronologically following one another. I think that is obvious from Acts 1, and therefore there really is no conflict between the Gospels. Luke's emphasis in the way he constructs the end of his first account, Luke, is to set up the second account. His preoccupation in the second account, in the opening of Acts, is the day of Pentecost and the coming of the promised Spirit of God. So he's ended his first account in such a way that he has set that up. Next point is, I think it's important to realize that the nature of Jesus' resurrection is not that he was resuscitated to his pre-crucified existence. He didn't just come back to life and have the same order of being, the same kind of being, the same kind of existence that had been killed at the crucifixion. He actually was apparently raised to an entirely different order of existence. That, I think, explains in part why they did not readily recognize him. Because it wasn't just Jesus, it was the resurrected Jesus. And it wasn't Jesus either. It was the resurrected Jesus. This was the Jesus who had transcended finite physical material existence as we have it and had gone on to a whole new glorified existence, probably the very kind of existence that we will be raised to one day. In Colossians, he's called the firstborn from the dead. He's called the firstborn among many brethren by Paul. And I think both of them, or in both passages, Paul is acknowledging that what Jesus went on to be raised to was a new glorified kind of existence that we will share. We are going to have that same kind of existence, but he was there first, and he arrived there first. So they didn't recognize him. He was able to suddenly appear and disappear, come into the middle of a locked room without coming through the door, just showing up. All that, and then his final ascension into heaven, all of that, I think, bespeaks of a man who is not an ordinary man like you and I. He was an entirely different sort of being. Now, that raises a problem, of course. The objection could be raised, well, he seems to be trying to make the case that he's not a ghost, he's not a spirit, he's flesh and bones, he says. He has marks in his hands and his feet. If God is going to bother to give him a new body, a glorified body, why leave the scars behind? I don't know. I don't know the answers to those questions. Will Jesus have those scars throughout all of eternity? On the one hand, it wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me if he will have those scars for all of eternity, because they're probably signs, emblems, marks of one of the most significant acts that he ever did in this existence, in the existence that he shared with us now. That may be true of all of us. It's this interesting thing in the New Testament. We're going to go to a whole new order of existence one day, and yet that whole new order of existence does not nullify, negate, void, and erase this existence. There's both discontinuity and continuity at the same time. The things that I do, the things that happen to me, what I am, the role that I play here and now on this earth, is not just forgotten and erased. Who I am in eternity is going to somehow subsume and incorporate everything that I am, everything that I have done, everything that I will do in this life. And yet, you know, which sounds horrible on the one hand, and yet the tragedy, the sorrow, the grief, the fall, the mistakes, the sin, the rebellion, all that makes up who I am now is somehow going to be woven together into this final product that is the very final blessing that God had in store for me from before the foundation of the earth. Even my mistakes, even my sins, even my even those times that I spit in the face of God, all that stuff, the consequences of all that stuff, are somehow going to be redeemed by God and given back to me in the form of an individual identity in eternity that doesn't erase all that, that doesn't just say you were nothing back then, you didn't count back then, let me make a whole new being and call it you. No, he doesn't make a whole new being and call it me. It is me, with my history, with the continuity of everything that I am and everything that I've done, and yet not touched by human hands, not marred by sin and guilt and evil, but actually a glorious and wonderful reward and blessing that God will give to me. So if they are marks, they are not scars. They are banners of the heroic act of Jesus. So they're transformed and yet visible, transformed and yet there. So it wouldn't surprise me if he bears those marks for all of eternity. On the other hand, what do I know about that order of existence? Maybe you can make the marks come and go at will. I mean, I don't know. Maybe the order of our being will be such that we can transmute the form that we take or something like that. We just don't know the answer to those questions. I want to comment a little bit on the nature of Jesus' obedience in these last days, going way back to the crucifixion, and we looked at that several weeks ago, the struggle that he was having in Gethsemane, but the incredible, incredible act of obedience. I really don't want to do this, Father, but it's not about what I want, it's about what you want. That's his obedience, but it's important to see here, and we can now see it at the end, it is not pure altruism that drove Jesus to do what he did. I know there's something in us that finds that incredibly offensive because we really want ethics to be ultimately rooted in altruism. Bertrand Russell, in his book, Why I'm Not a Christian, he has a chapter on the horrible, awful ethical teaching of Jesus, because Jesus taught us that we should not lay up treasures for ourselves on earth where they can be lost or stolen or destroyed, but lay up treasures for ourselves in heaven where they can't be lost or stolen or destroyed. And Bertrand Russell thinks that he has a much better ethical sense than Jesus did, because he thinks you shouldn't do things to lay up any treasures at all. You should do it just for the good of the other and never for the good of yourself. You never have that kind of ethical teaching in the Bible. It is always a question, of course I am the center of my universe. Of course I want my life to be rewarding to me. Of course I want my life and existence to end well. That's a given. You'd be a fool and an idiot and not even a human being if you thought otherwise. I mean, even if you think that you can think otherwise, good luck. Of course, that is the center of your and focus of your concern. Altruism is a false, illusory idea. We don't do things for other people to negate ourselves, to abolish ourselves, to erase ourselves. We do things for other people because I'm a better person when I do that, because I receive a reward, because I become a substantial human being and not an empty suit. That's why we pursue goodness, is because goodness is good for me. It is good for me to be good. Well, we see that with Jesus, and Paul makes it clear in Philippians. Why did Jesus do this cross thing? Why did he allow himself to be held in contempt and mocked and suffer and die in the way that he did? Paul says, for the glory set before him, he endured the cross. And that's what we see here is at the ending of Luke. In the end, he didn't stay dead. In the end, he was raised to a whole new order of existence, and he attained an incredible reward of being the firstborn from the dead. And for all of eternity, Jesus now is Lord of lords and King of kings, the firstborn of all creation, the most important creature that God ever created. And that's going to be his eternal role and his eternal existence, corresponding to the incredible depth of suffering that he endured in order to qualify to that end. Finally, let's comment a little bit on the faith of Jesus that we see here. Why was he able and willing to endure what he endured? Well, in part, it's because he believed God was in control. You know, to give yourself over to mobs and political machinery and all that kind of stuff is very, very scary if you think that it's out of control, if you think it's out of any, of God's control. So clearly, Jesus had to be believing that Pilate, the mob, everybody concerned was being controlled by God himself. It was God's will that was being done. But what does it look like to believe that God's will is being done? All too often, I'm afraid that the idea we have is that I need, by the force of my will, to set my fear aside and instead embrace the idea that God is in control, and falsely infer from the fact that God is in control, falsely infer then that nothing bad will happen to me. And so I go through life and I'm confronted by incredible fear and anxiety as I face into the unknown future. How do I deal with that? How does faith look at that? I tell myself, well, God is in control. God is in control. God is in control. God is in control. Thinking that what I'm saying to myself is, God won't let anything bad happen to me. God won't let anything bad happen to me. God won't let anything bad happen to me. And just by sheer force of will, believe that God won't let anything bad happen to me instead of believing that something bad will happen to me. And then we call that faith. I think that's a counterfeit faith. That's not the real thing at all. It's not that, that's not the nature of the comfort that God's sovereignty should bring. Rather, faith is combining my conviction, and it is a conviction that God is in control, not a belief that God is in control, if you understand my distinction. It's the knowledge that it is true that God is in control, combining that conviction that God is in control of every detail of my life with an authentic desire that God's will be done. That's faith. God, you are in control. I know that that's true. And you are going to do what you are going to do. And I want that. I authentically, genuinely, from the depth of my being, want your will to play out in history and to play out in my life. And whatever the outcome, whatever the implications of your will being done, gulp, I accept it. I want it. And I say gulp because if we understand that God is in control of every detail of my life, I understand that God's will may not protect me from all harm. He may have no intention of protecting me from all harm. He may very well take me through the cross itself, as he did with Jesus. That's faith. And that was Jesus' faith. Jesus knew good and well what the implications of God's will being done were. He was going to suffer terribly. And the human being that Jesus was didn't really much like that. He really didn't prefer to have to do that. But he did want the glory set before him. And because he did want the glory set before him, he knew that you either accept the will of God or you don't accept the will of God. When you accept the will of God, you must accept it in its entirety. Everything that God has in store, you're either embracing it or you're rejecting it. Those who reject it don't have a glory set before them. Those who reject the will of God have no reward in the final analysis. Jesus understood that, and because he understood that, he was willing to submit to whatever harm, whatever tragedy, whatever disappointment, whatever sorrow was in store for him. He was willing to submit to that in order to get the glory set before him. That's faith. It offers no reassurance that I will undergo no harm or suffering, but it offers the hope that any suffering I do undergo is part of the will of a sovereign God whose will is of ultimate benefit and reward for me, if I'm willing to accept and embrace God's will in its entirety, including the suffering. Okay, that's the end of Luke, and you may very well have some questions about what we talked about today or any time during the series.
Thanks very much, Jack. Just right at the end, I was curious, you may have said this and I likely missed it, but you used the phrase reject the will of God or something to that effect,
mm-hmm.
In contrast to accepting it and the sovereignty goes with it and so forth and so on. So what would it look like in the context of God's complete sovereignty and control over every circumstance, large and small? What would it mean to reject the will of God? What do you have in mind there?
Well, most of this, I think that's what's so profound about Kierkegaard's thought, is his recognition that all the stuff that counts is what he calls inwardness. And we saw that earlier in Luke. That's part of Jesus' teaching as well. The stuff that really, where it's really happening is in, it's hard to even have the right word for it, but in the insides, it's at the depth of what makes me me. I can't resist the will of God by thwarting it. It's going to happen, but what I can do is not embrace it from the depth of my passions and desires and proclivities and my orientation toward it. Can be God damn you for doing what you've done, rather than thank you, God, that you are my author. You know? So it's all a matter of that inner orientation toward what God is doing in my life. You really tend to see it in people, in yourself, when God comes along and does some mean, nasty thing to you.
The physics test.
Sorry?
The physics test?
Yes. And you have to resolve. You have to resolve for yourself. How am I going to orient myself toward this? Notice I said reject, not accept clumsily. Accepting clumsily is fine. As long as we accept the will of God, it doesn't matter how graceful we are. We're not going to be very graceful. We're going to thrash around and fight it and resist it, and because this is not an easy thing to do. I mean, it's a miracle that any of us embrace the will of God. But in the final analysis, to resolve in my heart, no, God, I really understand what's going on here. You are the author of an incredible narrative here called reality, and I'm a character, I'm a player within that reality, and I really want your story to be worked out the way you want to work it out. And whatever that means for me, so be it. I mean, to be able to say that is an incredible miracle on the insides of a human being, but that's what marks us as children of God, I think.
It's well with my soul. Didn't the author of that write that after having his three daughters drown in a shipwreck or something like that? And he wrote it then.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So keeping with that topic, so we were talking more in terms of like calamity or misfortune.
Calamity or what'd you say?
Or misfortune,
yeah.
As we would say, like all this bad thing happened to me, and now I have to choose how I respond to that. If you're defining the will of God as that which happens, you know, just put plainly, you know, whatever happens is the will of God, then it's kind of an ethical conundrum because, well, okay, calamity is one thing, but what about, like, actual sinful impulses and behavior? Is that also the will of God? Because what then would it mean to accept that or reject that? You know, if we accept it as the will of God that I am an evil person, it's kind of an ethical conundrum if we also say that, well, God doesn't want us to be evil in the long run. Going back to something you said earlier, too, you said that, you know, there can't be an error exactly. There can't be a mistake that will not be redeemed, you know, in the world to come, and that your memory and your being will include what you once considered to be mistakes, but they'll no longer be errors in the sense that they'll have been transformed into something with redemptive value. So, I mean, is that a model that we can embrace for everything in the sense that, you know, there's nothing that we can do that is a mistake? Or are there some things that are mistakes and in that sense are not the will of God because they won't have redemptive value?
Well, to answer that, you have to make a distinction. I think there's a lot of confusion that occurs because both in the Greek language and in the English language, there's an ambiguity in the word will. We use the word will to describe preference, desire, want, liking on the one hand, and we use the word will to describe what one has chosen or elected on the other hand. So this would not be particularly idiomatic, but if I said, I want to go over to, I will to go over to Cold Stone and get some ice cream, but I will not to, that would not be a contradiction. That is, I really have a hankering for some ice cream, but I choose not to give in to that hankering. I choose not to indulge. And we would use the same, we could use the same English word, and the Greeks could use the same Greek word in either sense. The longing, the desire, the preference on the one hand, and the actual choice on the other hand. That same ambiguity is used in the New Testament to describe God. When it says God wills that none should perish, for example, it's talking about his desire, his orientation, what he likes, what he would prefer. On the one hand, God prefers that none perish, but he doesn't choose to tell that story, at least if I'm right in the way I read the rest of the New Testament. He wills it, but he doesn't will it. He wants it, but he doesn't choose it. So sin in my life is both willed and not willed by God at the same time. On the one hand, he doesn't want me to sin. He doesn't want me to be that kind of being. On the other hand, from the standpoint of God, of the narrative that God is creating, does he choose to make me a sinner at that point? Absolutely, yes. Even that is in God's hands. And even that will ultimately be redeemed. That and the consequences of that will ultimately be redeemed by God and handed back to me as my reward.
For some people.
For those who submit to the will of God and want it and embrace it. Yeah.
But just to point out one more thing, though, I mean, in the conflict of wills that, you know, prevents you from going to get ice cream, you know, that's because there's something that's greater than your initial desire for ice cream, which is like, oh, I don't have money for gas or ice cream, or we don't have time, or it's bad for my health or something. You know, so what is the block between God's desire to save everybody and the fact that it won't happen?
Yeah. Well, of course, ultimately, I'm not sure, because I'd have to know the mind of God better than I do that in order to answer that question adequately. But it's certainly plausible to think in terms of, I mean, the way I like to put it is the reality that we're part of, if we think of it in terms of a narrative, has an incredible tragic element to it. There are creatures who had the potential to be glorified right along with Jesus and be his brother, but who in their rebellion opted not to take that. Well, that's a tragic story. It's not tragic for every human being, but there's an incredible tragic element to it. Does God recognize the tragedy of that? I think the answer to that is, yeah. That's what it means. God wills that none should perish. God, that is a grievous reality to have that, to be an element in his story. Now, so we could ask the question, you're God. You can tell whatever story you want to. Why tell a tragedy? Well, I don't know, but I think what he's saying is, I wouldn't have preferred to tell a tragedy, but there's this other thing I wanted to say in my story, and I couldn't do it any other way. I mean, some things are so logically correlated that you can't do one without the other. So, for example, there can be no display of mercy if there is nothing to be merciful toward. So if you want to display mercy, then you're going to have to create a reality that includes things that need to be dealt with in mercy in order to express that. That's a logical correlation there. And even God cannot undo logic, I don't believe.
The point you made, not the last one, but the one before it, I really agree with it, and I think it's a really good point. But I think...
Remind me what we're talking about.
I'm going to remind you what I'm talking about. This was the talk about how ultimately there is a personal reward in doing good. I mean, yeah. I am doing good so that I might be the right kind of person and that sort of thing. I think that's a very important thing to emphasize. I don't disagree with anything you said, but there's a kind of a qualification, or I think, for it ultimately to be satisfying to us, because we're all aware, I mean, I think we're all aware of those people who embrace religion, embrace Christianity or whatever, and you feel like when they're being nice to you, that they don't really give a rip about you. They're concerned about portraying themselves as a certain kind of merciful person, which could sound like what it was that you were saying. So I want to add an addendum to that, and you tell me what you think about the addendum. But it seems to me that the command to love your neighbor as yourself, I can't be the sort of person that personally gains from being a good person who loves my neighbor as myself if I don't actually love my neighbor as myself, which means that I actually am, when I look at my neighbor, thinking, that's a person like me. If I were in their spot, I would want that to be treated in this way. And so my act of goodness is a genuine act of, I care about you as much as I care about myself, or loving God as I actually, in fact, embrace God and I want what he is and all that loving God entails. It seems to me, though, what we're saying is that it is in the nature of things that you can't ultimately embrace the good, God, what God has intended to be, ultimately the world to be, without being blessed by it ultimately. I mean, goodness, loving your neighbor as yourself, is the very thing that we were created for and part of what gives satisfaction to life. So it's like both of those things are happening at the same time. So it's not altruism in the sense that the virtue arises from the fact that I don't get anything out of it. That's not true. It's not, virtue isn't determined by whether I get anything out of it. It's determined by, in the case of loving your neighbor as yourself, that I'm actually acting on my neighbor's behalf because I care about them as much as I do for myself. But then in the nature of things, I do benefit from that, and I can't change reality to make it so that I don't. And it's not wrong to value that. I mean, I'm looking forward to the day when my sin is erased and I truly love God and love my neighbor in the way that I am intended to do. And when I'm in that spot, I will be less self-centered than I have ever been, but I personally will be in a better place than I have ever been. And both of those things go together. Now, does that sound?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well said. Yeah, what I'm saying is the most self-fulfilling thing that I can do is to be a person whose life is given to others and not about myself. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Hi,
Hi, Jack.
Hi.
I'm interested in the implications for us on, like, the fact that we'll, like, have resurrected bodies. Because I've, like, run around in the mainstream Christian circle some, and it seems like the resurrected body doesn't really get enough attention.
Does not get enough attention, you say?
Yeah. Like, I think that there still is, like, this widely circulated idea of heaven as, like, we're, like, disembodied spirits, and, like, we don't really we don't really have identities, or like we do, or like our identity that we have now gets demolished and like replaced with some like totally different person. And I think like in postmodernity and like with the deconstruction of like Cartesian or Aristotelian dualism, like there's been a lot of confusion about the status of the body. And it seems like the resurrected body, like as, you know, modeled like by Jesus, but something that like we'll each have, is like a really rich theological resource for like navigating some like confusion that a lot of young people I think have about like the self and like, who am I and what does, like, my body mean? Can you speak to that?
Well, on the one hand, I mean, the tendency in modern academic circles is to make me my body. That
yeah.
My body is so much, defines who I am, that there isn't anything else. I think that's wrong because there really is a non-substantial something that is far more centrally who I am than my body, on the one hand. On the other hand, you're absolutely right. The more classical, traditional view of being disembodied and being just spirits somewhere is, we don't get that from the scripture at all. I mean, it's Plato. It's not in the Bible. Clearly, my destiny is to be an embodied person for all of eternity. And it's important to see that my future is continuous with my present in that regard. I am my body in a significant way here, and I will be my body in the same significant way in eternity. So yeah, I think that's very important to make that adjustment and to get that clear.
Thanks, Jack. My dad's been talking a lot about heaven too, and so this... and Dave and I, you know, we spend our lives telling stories. And so when you talk about looking at the life as though God is the great storyteller, or this narrative and this idea of the sense of tragedy, or in theater we're always looking for, you know, great plays have great conflict to be overcome through action. And so it makes me wonder, too, if we are ourselves and maybe, you know, we have memories of this life in the next, and... you know, are we going to keep telling that great story again and again that once had tragedy? Or where will be the interest of conflict to continue to make the glory so glorious? Will there be some kind of problem to overcome, do you think, in the next life?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, if I'm understanding him right, that Lewis basically answers that by saying that he thinks that there will be continuing conflict. And the form that it will take will be... you know, that there will continue to be adventure, danger, threat, and so on. It's just that threat will not be ultimate because it cannot destroy my existence. One of the ways that he, if I'm remembering this correctly, has been decades since I've read it, but I think in his space trilogy, in the first one, Out of the Silent Planet, he has a group of people on some planet that is unfallen. But there's this monster figure that they go out and fight occasionally, and occasionally one of the monster gets one of the creatures, and then they have a celebration because they have been translated to the next order of existence. So it's not tragic because there is no tragic end ultimately for any of the creatures there. But there was threat, there was danger, there was conflict, there was opposition, and they... it was an annual event or something like that to go out and fight the monster. I probably got it all wrong. I mean, I make up all kinds of stories that were never written. But what I took from it is that Lewis is playing with the idea that reality is not going to be more, eternity is not going to be more boring than this one. It's going to be less boring. I just think it will be filled with all kinds of adventure. I mean, how could it be more glorious? I mean, that's why our traditional images of heaven are just hell. You know, how many times can I say, you know, praise be to God and not get bored out of my ever-loving mind? You know, and have it still be meaningful. So if the way I'm wired now is, if this life is so textured and so multi-dimensional, so many aspects to it, is it going to be fewer aspects in eternity? I don't think so. If anything, there will be more sources of conflict, more ground for conflict and adventure. But there will be no final death, and there will be no evil, and there will be no futility. I'll go there.
Jack, I continue to be stuck in the conundrum of my free will and God's determination. Mm-hmm. And that it's glorious that I want and choose here to aspire to his kingdom, but I don't do that without his will. I'm stuck in that conundrum, and I don't want to try to portend the question any further. Can you just add to it from your philosophy of divine determinism?
Well, the important thing, there's a false premise in the way you ask the question, I think, and that is, see, how did you put it? Let me see. I want to pursue his kingdom, but I can't apart from his will. Or I think that's how you put it. Is that right?
It's okay.
No, that's not true. You can want it if you want it. You can want it if you will freely choose it. Nothing stands in the way of your freedom choosing what you want. Now, coming along after the fact as an outside observer, if someone asks me the question, why did so-and-so choose it rather than not choose it? The ultimate explanation for that is because God chose them first, because God willed to have them. And we see that God willed to have them because they freely chose the kingdom of God rather than in their freedom rejecting it. So from the standpoint of where you sit and where you live, the only relevant reality is your freedom. Nothing stands in the way of my freedom going the way I'm going to go. But I'm a free creature created by God, authored by God. God is going to determine from the standpoint of his sovereignty what I do with my freedom and where I go in my freedom. But it's not like I'm sitting here with all my ducks in a row all ready to make the choice, but I need God's will to come along and add to what I've got in order to choose him. You see what I'm saying? It's not an ability he's giving me. It's not a power pack he's giving me. It's not an inducement that he's supplying that isn't already there. It's the choice itself that needs to be made. And that choice has two sides to it. The resolve of Stan's will and the determination of God are just two sides of exactly the same event, two ways of looking at exactly the same event. One more, and then we got to call it a morning.
So one thought, just in terms of this question of the new body, it seems to me that when we work through our character or talk about our souls or something like that, you know, we have in mind, you know, the Apostle Paul saying, I don't do what I want to do, and I do what I don't want to do, and lo and behold, there's sin within me. And we can understand there's something deep within us that's going to change. We may not fully be able to completely get our minds around it because we're so immersed in this life, but we understand that this principle of sin, which is really a principle of death at our character level and at our will be transformed.
Yeah.
And it seems that we I think we kind of understand it a little bit too, but we sometimes have a hard time getting our minds around it, that there's also this principle of death at a very physical level, that in all of creation, you know, every cell lives and then eventually dies. I mean, it doesn't continue on. And so my thought is, well, maybe when we talk about a new body and a new earth, we're talking about a world in which there's kind of a correspondence there, just like death is removed at the level of our will and our character. There's also a transformation in the world in which death does not reign even at that physical level. I don't know. Maybe plants will grow and die. I'm not sure. But it seems to me that that if, as we try to understand what would it be like to live in a world where there's no sin, you know, we could maybe also imagine what would it be like to live in a world in which cells continue on in the way that it seems like they're designed to by God, but this mystery of death that seems to destroy them is gone, and so life can continue on at its fullest level, and continue to live on in the way that that seems like, when you go back to the creation account, seems like that's maybe, you know, an idea there, a thought there, that this is what it's going to be, you know, but for now, you know, we don't see that. We see death, but there will be life at that level. And so maybe Christ's body is still very much a body, just like ours in his transformed state, but also fundamentally, radically different too, because death at the physical level is no longer there. He's not a mortal human.
Right.
That died on a cross, but now he's transformed.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think that's exactly right. It's paralleled by what's going to happen to all the rest of creation. That's what's implicit in the early part of Romans 8, is that the creation itself longs to be set free from corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. So God is actually going to rewrite physics, I believe, in the new heavens and the new earth, in our glorified state, much along the lines of what you're talking about, and we can only speculate and can only barely imagine what that would be like.
And I think if we think along those terms, then it's not a negation of this life.
Right.
It's not a negation of the creation that God said, boy, that was a big mistake. Let's do something different. It's a radical transformation that we can call new. We can say it's so fundamentally changed in some regards that it's new, but yet it's also a substantiation of everything that God started in the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's right. Need to let you go. Thank you.